Welcome to The Minefield, a program that tries to navigate the ethical dilemmas of modern life. I'm Laura D'Olimpio, and together with Nin Kirkham, we have staged a coup and usurped Scott and Waleed from their usual radio thrones in order to celebrate International Women's Day. Would I lie to you? As the Eurythmics sang in our opening sequence, no, I would not say something that wasn't true, even though there are a lot of double negatives in those lyrics. And the truth of the matter is that today, Nin and I are here for 1 week only to disrupt the usual order of things. But never fear, Waleed and Scott will be back with you next week. So who are we? I'm Laura D'Olimpio. I teach philosophy at the University of Notre Dame in Fremantle. And my co-host is Nin Kirkham, who teaches philosophy at the University of Western Australia. Hi, Nin.
Hi, Laura. Very nice to be here with you, two female philosophers in a very male-dominated field. It's exciting to be here to celebrate International Women's Day, the theme of which is Women in the Changing World of Work, Planet 50-50 by 2030. So as I said, still lots of work to do in the field of philosophy and many other fields, but certainly is a positive thing to work towards. By 2030, 50% representation in our discipline would certainly make the world a better place.
It would be incredible to think that out of the employed academic philosophers, there's only 25%. So to have some more female voices is nothing but a good thing.
I couldn't agree more, Laura.
And as you might have gathered from our opening theme, today we're going to be looking at the virtue of honesty in what is increasingly being referred to as a post-truth age. So the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year for 2016 is post-truth. An adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So what could be better than two philosophers discussing old-fashioned virtues such as honesty and interrogating whether or not they are still relevant today? And by relevant, I do mean truth in a post-truth age, rather than philosophy itself, which is perhaps another question for another day. So I'm particularly interested in if there's any room for political honesty in a post-truth age. And I think what's interesting about this question is that I wonder if there's much different now than has been in the past. So if we consider what shaped public opinion in the past, there's always been hugely charismatic figures whose popularity is not necessarily predicated on how much they know or the truth that they speak. It's rather on, you know, their persuasion and what they represent. And so politics, you know, has always been rife with such fakery, so much so that it's not surprising that it plays out like reality TV, which isn't very real at all. And the media coverage is all about the words and the drama, the staging, the personalities, not really anything so dull as the actual policies or how they might affect ourselves. So we've always had this level of deception in politics and in politicians. And what is so different now about this so-called post-truth age? What do you think, Nin?
Well, I agree with you, Laura. I don't think that the global political situation we find ourselves in is manifestly different in kind from what's gone on in various periods in the past. The difference to me, well, there's several differences that I'd like to talk about, but the difference seems to be partly the degree to which we are and can be exposed to misinformation and fake news through media platforms, the speed at which misinformation can pass through our systems of communication. As you pointed out, truth has always been a tricky thing politically. But in the past, we were perhaps willing to admit that while people were entitled to their own opinions and maybe even their own interpretation of the facts, they weren't entitled to their own facts. But it seems that in the post-truth era, even the facts are up for grabs. And we've even got a new term to describe those facts that are up for grabs, given to us by the lovely Kellyanne Connolly, alternative facts. Okay, we can help ourselves to alternative facts if the actual ones don't suit our political purpose. So I do think there are some interesting issues raised by the notion of post-truth, or the slightly older notion of truthiness. So in a recent study out of UWA, you know, plug for my institution, they suggested that when supplied with information attributed to Donald Trump, people who supported him were more likely to believe in the truth of that information. And even the knowledge that Trump was misinforming them was unlikely to change their voting preferences. So this is the kind of phenomenon that leads people to claim that we're in a post-truth era. But the question is, What exactly is so different from the past, apart from these things? What do you think, Laura?
Well, I'm just wondering if people maybe perhaps aren't that worried about political truth or what politicians are saying at all. And maybe this isn't very different to what's gone on beforehand. So just to play devil's advocate, perhaps the virtues of, you know, being a good neighbour and truth and honesty and respect for one another hasn't really gone by the wayside as much as it seems in the political arena. Perhaps in everyday life, people are living their lives, you know, with perfect respect and getting along just fine with their neighbours. They're meeting the parents of the other kids at their schools, their colleagues who are all from different countries, have different religious backgrounds, and they're not having much problem with getting along, you know, for the most part. So perhaps when they look at the politicking that goes on and the media representation of what politicians are saying, they don't really believe them anyway. Perhaps they don't care that much. They've got other things to be concerned about. And so perhaps they recognise that this is just like reality TV. It's entertaining. But at the end of the day, they're going to go to those polling booths. And in WA, of course, this is going to happen on Saturday. And they're going to go vote for the party that they've always voted for. And this is why election campaigns are so successful, because they're not trying to educate the general public about the policies and how those policies are going to affect anyone. They're just scare campaigns that are trying to make an emotional impact.
I don't disagree with you about the emotional impact that political campaigning has on people, but I do wonder about what you said about people voting for the parties that they've previously voted for. And I think we are seeing this swing towards alternative parties. And I think that's part of the phenomenon that's captured by the notion of post-truth. So what I'm getting at is that for me, the single most important thing in understanding what a post-truth environment might be is seeing that it's not facts at all that are doing the work of changing people's beliefs. It's actually authority. So as I understand it, the post-truth phenomenon is a shift towards a belief in power or authority rather than a belief in truth. And I think that study out of UWA shows that if Trump says it, it's true, or it might as well be. And even if it isn't, we still like Trump because he's a powerful guy and we think he might do the work that we want him to do. So I think that a lot of people who feel that they might have been unwitting victims of the rise of neoliberalism, though I don't want to get too much into that, they don't care about any abstract notion of truth. What they want is a person, an authority to believe in, someone who speaks with authority and who they think can actually look after their interests. That, to me, captures the essence of the post-truth era.
And, of course, this seems extremely dangerous when we even look at the interview that happened on Sunday between Barry Cassidy and Pauline Hanson, and she was, you know, questioning whether or not vaccines are linked to autism. She's questioning whether or not Russia is responsible for MH17 and, you know, sort of upholding Putin as someone to be considered as a good, strong, exemplary leader. Then if the authority of just someone in a public position is giving that idea some kind of truthiness and that people are grasping onto because, you know, they're sick of the main two political party system, then we are starting to head down this slippery slope of a dangerous territory.
We sure are. I think the Hanson situation hits that point that I just made. Exactly. I mean, she is someone who has explicitly stated that she thinks Putin's a good leader because he is authoritative, he is powerful and willing to, you know, make the hard decisions in her view of the situation. But I mean, another thing that is very concerning about her agenda is such things as the vaccine question, where peer-reviewed scientific, well-established facts are just questioned or undermined in the face of misinformation, websites, propaganda. I think that's really frightening, and I suppose that's the speed to which this kind of misinformation can spread in this post-truth age, if we want to call it that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if she's encouraging parents to sort of go out and do their own research, I mean, Barry Cassidy's reply was perfect here. He said, well, what makes the parent more informed than a medical expert or the scientific community who have, over the course of years, you know, revisited these studies and tested them out and decided that this is the collective truth or fact of the matter. And then, you know, I think you were right to point out to the social media and new technology of Web 2.0, where you can go online and, because of those echo chambers, just find other opinions that agree with you, and then you confirm and reinforce myths or, you know, your denying stance.
Absolutely. And I think part of that problem is a notion of research that's very loose and very broad, where research is, you know, typing a couple of keywords into Google and finding what pops up first and thinking that that's doing research. And then, in the same breath, thinking that peer-reviewed scientific evidence is not something that we should rely on. So there's a real misunderstanding of how research is done and what its purpose is, I think.
So it's not just about the question of truth. It's also about who are the legitimate holders and conveyors of truth, and who are the experts who are allowed to speak with authority, with an appropriate authority, about what is actually the case.
That's right. I think another aspect of the post-truth era is this erosion of expertise, of the faith in expertise. And I think we're seeing that in the American climate, and even with Hanson's recent comments about vaccine, it's in the Australian political mix now, that there's a real undermining of expertise, and thinking that anyone who can use the internet is an expert on whatever they want to be.
It is certainly a worry, but luckily for us, we actually are going to bring in an expert into our conversation here. So you're listening to The Minefield. I'm Laura D'Olimpio, and I'm joined in the driver's seat today by Nin Kirkham. We're both philosophers from Western Australia. We've staged a coup of sorts, an authorised coup, and no, Scott and Wiley don't have the day off, but they've kindly handed over the mics to us as a part of Radio National's International Women's Day initiative. I did promise them that I'd remind you that you can leave a comment on the website. Just search RN The Minefield or tweet us at RN The Minefield.
So I'd like to welcome our guest, Professor Anne Tiernan from the School of Government and International Relations at Griffith University. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Laura. Hi, Nin. Great to be with you. And it's a bit of a federal coup too, isn't it? A Queenslander and two Western Australian women. It's even more dramatic than often happens.
Absolutely.
We're representing all kinds of minorities, aren't we?
That's right.
So, Anne, first I'd like to invite you to tell us what you think about this focus on political honesty and the claim that we've entered a post-truth age. Do you think we're in a political environment that's it's no longer fact but authority that's the basic source for people's beliefs?
Well, I think it's a really interesting notion that people are looking for sources of strength. I think that's more authoritarian than authority. I have a slightly different take on this issue, and I am a political scientist, not a philosopher. Most of my research is focused on the work of governing. So I spend a lot of time with the people doing the work of governing, trying to understand what it is that they think they're doing when they do it. And I think I've really noticed a phenomenon that's slightly different but related, which is a real diminution of respect, a real loss of respect and trust at so many different levels of our political system. And I do think the kind of the cynicism that many punters, as they're described in an extraordinarily disrespectful way by the parties, have been brought to this point by the parties themselves, by their persistent failure to engage with people's genuine concerns, by slogans, by themselves attacking sources of expertise as they've become more hyper-partisan and adversarial. So I think in a way they're reaping the bitter harvest of the professionalisation and importation of campaign techniques that have been very divisive. And we can see, you know, markedly that collapse in trust in the Australian election study that the ANU produces. There's a really major shift from 2007. But why do we get so disappointed? Why do we become so cynical? It's because we expect more of our institutions. And that's why people, I think, are disappointed and can't understand how these things have happened. So they're looking for our institutions to do something different. And if those inside them, inhabiting them, are disrespecting them and diminishing them, then little surprise people would look to outsiders to disrupt that.
Yeah. So if I understand you correctly, would you say that this breakdown of trust, this loss of honesty in politics, this notion of the post-truth age is just one manifestation of that loss of respect, general respect, so a lack of respect for the truth?
Well, a lack of respect for other points of view. a lack of respect for an alternative way of seeing the same thing or an alternative way of interpreting the same thing. You're either with me or against me in this very volatile and hyper-partisan environment. I think that's different. And, of course, in my context and looking federally, looking at the Commonwealth level, you can see that shift in the way that the parties interacted with each other really from the shift to the new Parliament House. As you break down people's interaction and relationship with each other, you get more distance. And we're seeing this virtually now, but it long preceded. People used to get on in the old Parliament House. They knew each other. They didn't deal with each other in sort of crude stereotypes and through the proliferation of staffers all looking for something to, you know, keep themselves in work. So I think there's lots and lots of things that have happened in our politics that have kind of increased the distance between representatives and the people they represent. And that's kind of about volume and workload. And there's lots of legitimate reasons why that's happened. But they're also surrounded, and this is something I'm working on at the moment, by kind of courts, small courts, informal courts of people who reinforce their own views and beliefs.
And courts of sycophants or something like that?
Courts of people who think like you and who... Yeah. So it's kind of narrow casting, but it's not digital. And I think in lots of ways, many of us are moving in that environment. The nature of professional politics kind of makes that happen. And I just think that, you know, as those distances have come to bear, it's much easier to kind of disrespect and not engage with people who you don't know very well, people with whom you're not interacting. I just think it's interesting to sort of think about this whole notion as a sort of a manifestation of disrespect. It's something I'm kind of become a bit obsessed with at the moment, as you can tell.
And this sounds like a really interesting point. And I wonder if we widen it out to the global scale, we're seeing similar tensions and almost contradictions at a global level. Because if we link it back to this notion of the role that the media and technology plays, we've got more connection than ever before. It seemed as if the great, democratic, to use the word properly, possibility of technology was to enable us to inhabit others' worlds in ways that we haven't before, to really be able to see that there are others all over the world living all different kinds of lives, and yet, importantly, they're still essentially like us. They're still living this human life with the same challenges. And yet, at the same time, as you're pointing out, we've got these echo chambers where we're only seeking out our own narrow point of view and having it reflected back to us. Do you think this might be some of the cause of that lack of trust of others and, you know, that disrespect that comes?
Yeah, it's a sort of a double-edged sword, isn't it, which was interesting because it's done all those things that you've talked about, but it's also had this unintended consequence of narrow casting and narrow channeling. But I think, you know, one of the things, you know, you've talked a lot about honesty in politics, you've talked a lot about those kinds of, you know, expectations and virtues. But I think, you know, we've seen this before. We've actually seen this before historically. In a way, it's a pity we haven't got a historian with them because they could say, well, this looks very like things that have happened in the past. So authoritarians need to construct other. They need to have people who are with me or against me. And one of the first things they try and do is to undermine education, learning, knowledge in order, you know, to not have a challenge to the kinds of claims that they're making. So I think that's quite interesting. But there's never been more transparency in terms of the, you know, opportunities for oversight or finding out what's going on in politics and government. And in a way that's had, a paradoxical effect of the more people have seen, the more they suspect things are going on. But of course, information comes out into a very hostile environment often. And I think if you talk to politicians, as I do very regularly, they often themselves feel misrepresented. They often feel that context and nuance is lost from the point they were trying to make or the issue or, you know, their register of interests that they were trying to update or whatever. So there's lots of, you know, we have to think about, I think, the context and the environment in which lots of the information and knowledge that's passing is being exchanged and received.
Absolutely. And I think that idea of education also starts to hit that nail on the head. You've pointed out that we've got these subtle, complex truths. And I think truth is contextual and sometimes difficult to grasp. Mm. It's much easier to have this black and white, you know, with me or against me, this is the way it is. And people might want to hold on to that, and it gives them something to rally against and to grasp. But it's actually not very helpful in the real world if we don't recognise the nuances and understand that, yes, we're all humans living, you know, on global planet Earth, but we do have important and subtle differences that we need to make work all together. And to hear the other person's story, to actually have those ears to listen and to care about the other person's story.
Yeah, and of course, that's the job of the political representative, is to represent all the interests and all the people on for whom they're supposed to speak. And I think that's been the huge loss of trust, that many people feel that, in fact, elected representatives aren't representing them per se, but they're speaking to the speaking, you know, dot points. They're, you know, representing an interest, a donor, whatever. These are the kinds of anxieties that run through a lot of the critiques of our politics. So politics was really about trying to rationalise and reconcile difference, the legitimate differences of people, and trying to, you know, achieve a collective outcome. And I think there's less and less kind of tolerance for that in the culture, for whatever reason, at this kind of particular point in time. But I'm uncomfortable about, you know, are politicians lie or politicians do this. My experience is most people are well-intentioned. They go into this very bizarre and unhealthy work environment that is characterised by scarcity, madness and neurosis. So I think we have to kind of think about that and what we expect of our representatives. And I think too, and I'm interested in your view about this, how come many of us who are dissatisfied with politics don't ourselves step in? What's the respect, you know, situation going on there, or our commitment to democracy, that we want to be audience Democrats rather than participants? It's very interesting to sort of contemplate that, I think.
I don't know the answer to that. I think it's a really good question, and one that probably doesn't have a simple answer. It's very true what you're saying about the lack of respect, that goes both ways. So respect from the people, the punters, as you pointed out, for institutions and conventions, and for giving a fair hearing to politicians rather than just kind of judging them on sound bites that they hear through the media. And there's a lack of respect that we're kind of pointing out in terms of this post-truth way of communicating from politicians towards their constituencies.
Mm. But we're all losers, aren't we? We're all losers in that kind of environment.
That's right.
There's also a problem, even just in entering that media space, where female academics are less willing to speak up. And I think it is, you're less willing to have that criticism aimed at you. And there's been, again, lots of studies, especially online and things like that, where the kinds of trolling that occurs for women is a lot worse. There is a sort of a gendered language here when women speak with authority versus when men speak with authority.
Well, indeed. Or when women and male politicians are seen to have told the truth. The huge construction of Anna Bligh here in Queensland was as liar, having, you know, made a commitment, gone to an election, and then, you know, made some different decisions post-budget. There's something, and, you know, same with Julia Gillard, there's something very visceral and gendered about, you know, the untruths women politicians are seen to have, you know, told or created, as opposed to often their male colleagues. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. And these are subtle messages, aren't they, to women about participating in the public sphere. And we've seen the campaign, you know, in the US, we've seen that even some of those, you know, Donald Trump's attitudes to women were very often not challenged by people on his own side, in the interests of what power, as you
absolutely
pointed out.
Mm. And this will be a really interesting conversation that we can continue a bit further into our podcast. So we're actually going to have to start wrapping it up there. We want to thank our guest, Anne Ternan, Professor in the School of Government and International Relations at Griffith University. Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Anne. I'd just like to remind everyone that this is part of Radio National's International Women's Day coverage, and assure you that Scott and Waleed will be back behind the mics next week.
Are we going to give them back the mics, Nin?
We'll think about it, if they're good.
If they're behaving themselves. So thank you very much for listening to Radio National's The Minefield, and we'll continue discussing with Anne in the podcast extras, so you can check that out online. You're listening to The Minefield. This is Laura D'Olimpio and I'm joined by Nin Kirkham. We're taking over from Scott and Waleed for International Women's Day and we're just going into a further conversation as part of the podcast.
Hello, Laura. Hello, Anne. I take it you're still there.
I'm still here.
I just wanted to pick up on a point that you made, and I got halfway there through the main broadcast, but you talk about the lack of respect for institutions and conventions, and I think you're right about this. But as you point out, at least in state politics and probably more broadly, we've got more oversight and transparency than we ever did before. We've got more access to information about the goings-on in our democratic institutions than we've ever had before. But we seem to have this widespread disenchantment and cynicism and loss of faith in the integrity of institutions and conventions. It would be hard to deny, in light of that, there has been a breakdown in, you know, capital T trust. So I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about this. It strikes me that the operation of a democratic government requires trust, and oversight agencies can only do so much. They can only see what they're currently looking at. So it seems to me that the need for all of this oversight in the first place reinforces that there's been this loss of trust. And I suppose my question to you is how we might, or even whether we can, restore public trust in institutions. Trust that strikes me as fundamental to the proper operation of democratic government.
Yeah, so such an interesting kind of question. And then one that takes us back to the fact about the origins of oversight agencies in Queensland, an absolute crisis of trust in
Queensland.
Democracy and governance and the police service and all those kinds of things in this 30-year anniversary of the Fitzgerald Inquiry. In Western Australia, extraordinary issues through WA Inc. and all the controversies there. New South Wales ICAC also comes out of a crisis. So does the Victorian kind of will we, won't we get into this kind of oversight agency. The one jurisdiction that doesn't have one's the Commonwealth. There's indeed a Senate inquiry, I think, about to start on that. It's a fascinating sort of resistance, I think, at the Commonwealth level, which goes to the fact that, oh, no, we're a better sort of parliament. We don't need an oversight agency. Well, I think some people might disagree. So these things are sort of 30 years old, and the need for them derives from, I think, the lack of respect for the governing traditions and conventions of our system. So responsible government, the whole premise is on, it's, you know, very little of it's written down, actually. It's all about trust, reciprocity, mutuality, people respecting the rules of the game. And I do think that has been incredibly compromised. Now, oversight agencies kind of interrupt those traditions and conventions because people can't be trusted to behave that way. But in a way, then, they create their own, you know, while they might be necessary, they create their own dilemmas because it then becomes self-fulfilling that there's some oversight. But I tell you what, it does change people's behaviour, the expectation that what they write in their email will, you know, they have to think about what that's going to look like when the investigation comes. Now, I think one of the unfortunate things about that, though, is that crises are where we look, rather than the day-to-day mundane things that come out all the time. Very often academics will say to me, oh, you know, COAG is opaque. No one knows what goes on at COAG. Rubbish. There's a communique that comes out at the end of every meeting. And in fact, we know what's on the COAG agenda. You just have to know where to look. And this is one of the dilemmas about transparency, that you actually have to be able to navigate it in order to be able to find what you're looking for. And then you have to be able to kind of read and interpret it through some lens of expertise. So have we done a good enough job communicating the availability of information or things that people might want to know about? My own view is that people are more they're concerned about that. They're concerned about, you know, travel expenses and all that kind of stuff. But what they really want, or people abusing their power, they're very concerned about. Campaign financing is another one that's always up there. But what they really want to know, I think, or what they really want to be involved in is setting the priorities. And it's that people's concerns don't seem to have any relationship to the kind of priorities and agendas of governments. And one could talk about odd, you know, obsessions in any government. That's where I think people are really concerned. Their capacity to influence the agenda, be it housing affordability, be it, you know, tax reform or super reform or, you know, whatever, 18C. The things that parties are concerned with don't seem to be the things that they're concerned about.
I wonder, though, it seems to me that there's a wider issue that concerns me a lot more than, you know, people's ability to influence the agenda. It seems that actually we're micromanaging productivity. So part of this accountability and the lack of trust can be seen in all different kinds of institutions. So I'm thinking about universities now and how academics are micromanaged, and we spend so much time producing forms and reports about what we're doing without just being able to get on with it. And perhaps there's, you know, good reasons for that as well. But it's gone to such an extent that, you know, this over-concern about what are we producing at the end of it, instead of, you know, this inherent value for knowledge. And I think that ties back into things we were talking about in the show itself, about, you know, knowledge for its own sake and about a respect for expertise, that not all elitism is bad. If people have spent a lot of time building up a set of skills and knowledge, that then they should have the authority to be able to speak about that and be listened to. We recognise it in sporting all the time, sporting elites, and we worship those, in fact. But the space for the public intellectual and even the level of public discourse, which is reflected, you know, in the media and in politics, has gone downhill. And I wonder if part of the problem is that we're just trying to squeeze so much more product and, you know, I guess capital and things out of everybody.
So I'd like to respond to that, Laura. I mean, what you said about productivity and the oversight that occurs in universities and other institutions and political oversight, I think it's partly about squeezing productivity, but I think it's also, reflects a lack of trust in people, in their commitment to their jobs, in their willingness to do the right thing. I mean, it makes an assumption that most people are going to rot the system.
That's right.
And that's an assumption that we're applying to politics as well, is that, you know, most we need to check every single politician's expenses accounts because most of them are trying to scam it.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, because I think it is about disrespect and distrust of professionals or people who are seen to have too much autonomy in universities. I think they're a great example of
very,
you know,
good example.
These things kind of manifesting. But I think on, you know, the politics, kind of going back to politics, I think, you know, you alluded to something in our earlier discussion where you're sort of saying about why people will believe things that, you know, seem manifestly untrue, or they're presented with alternative information. I think brain science has a lot to tell us here, you know, in terms of the scarcity that characterises both our public debate but also our deliberations. You know, why do people in politics do dumb stuff? Well, maybe because they're depending on someone else to complete their return or to, you know, update their information or whatever. I don't think talk enough about scarcity, and we don't talk enough about a dependency in
so
all of these relationships.
Depending on
others,
other people,
because they are so hammered and they don't live normal lives. And I think we know so much about well-being and, you know, the function of the brain, but this is also true in universities and other kind of sectors where people feel so pressed. They just cannot. They're operating on high cortisol kind of all the time. It's not conducive to good decision making or good debate or empathy, frankly. And maybe that's, you know, some of the debate that we need to have.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that people are spread very, very thinly, especially in those public roles. The academy's not quite as public, but it's a similar situation where people, the expectations are so enormous, and people are constantly under the pump, politicians more so. And of course, in order to fulfil their responsibilities, they are having to outsource a lot of their job to other people and depend on them to do it well.
Sure.
So
and some
responsibilities
of the
spread across quite a disparate range of people.
I think that's right. And some of the collegiality that might have characterised our work environments in universities or, you know, in politics, in the conviviality of the members' bar, even though there were no women there and probably not a women's bathroom either. But, you know, that some of that conviviality is gone. And so it's little wonder it's joyless and, you know, and that people feel so, you know, misunderstood, I guess, on one level. And then at the level of the concern of an ordinary Australian, so little heard. Without
right.
having actually very much interest in or concern about that thing, because people have climbed over lots of bodies in a competitive environment to get there.
So it's harder to be virtuous when you're so pressed for time, when you're not your best self. As Aristotle would say, that we actually need those resources. We need a community that supports us being able to be kind to one another in what we're valuing. And these kinds of time constraints, actually, they actually do adversely affect women more as well. If women are doing more of the school drop-offs and pick-ups and this kind of thing, they can actually just cut into a woman's productivity more than a man's.
So on the topic of the International Women's Day and women's issues, you mentioned in a previous conversation, Anne, that you thought that the post-truth analysis was gendered. And I just wanted you to sort of end by talking about that and what you meant by that.
I don't think we can separate post-truth from disrespect and ego. Ego is the big is the big factor here, the elephant in the room, I think, or the elephant in the White House, in the Oval Office. So I think that whole cult of kind of individualism is more comfortably worn by these kind of titanic male characters who we've talked about. Clearly, there are women politicians, you know, who hold you know, more extreme views, and then, you know, in Europe, we're seeing the rise of many right wing female leaders. What's the gendered nature of all of this just strikes me constantly in the Trump administration, in just many other areas of public life. Disrespect of women seems to be endemic in many, and I can't help myself. I'll have to talk about the merit principle in the making of cabinets in Australia. You know, there's so many. We can only have so many women because, you know, everybody gets there on merit. Well, if that were true, the cabinets would look very different to the cabinets that we have if it was all done on merit. So I think there's just, you know, lots of these kind of codes and texts that are lending themselves in ways. I mean, even in the Hansen phenomenon, where it's not too far away that there are men, you know, powerful men who have always been around that movement. Many of the party's policy agendas, you know, are arguably, you know, concerned with women and what women are doing, the, you know, proposal to abolish the family court, some of these other kind of ideas. So I think, you know, I just think there is a gendered nature. I haven't had time to, you know, think it through. No doubt people will have comments and thoughts that they'll raise,
sure they will.
On the discussion board. But I think, you know, I do think there's something, you know, even the role that Kellyanne Conway is playing in the White House is a very interesting one for feminists, a big challenge to feminists, actually.
And that's a great point to end on. Thank you so much, Anne Ternan from Griffith University, for chatting to Nin and myself today on this special takeover of RN's The Minefield for International Women's Day.
Great work.
Thank you,
too.
Anne.
Thanks for having me.